This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Denise Pellegrini on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best. Look out below. Mark Mobius says interest rates are going way up.
You have 8% CPI, you have to have 9% interest rates. We're going to see higher and higher rates if these CPI numbers keep on coming this way.
Amazon's grand plans for Thursday night football.
I think this will be as big as when the NFL went to cable back in 1987. You know, we know how NFL games legitimized and grew the cable business, and we think the same thing can happen for streaming.
And Patrick McEnroe on the new generation of tennis stars.
Just amazing, but also these guys play with so much athleticism, and they love it, and the crowd love them.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week, powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
The Federal Reserve and inflation front and center this coming week as we head into the Fed meeting and the expected rate hike. Energy and shipping prices, some of the wild cards in the inflation picture right now. And we had a chance to ask John Pearson, the CEO of DHL Worldwide, about what's happening in the parcel delivery business in Europe right now. Of course, with all that's happening with FedEx and its big earnings miss, and the way, as we've been reporting, FedEx pulled its outlook for the year because of worsening business conditions, a lot of interest in what's happening in the parcel delivery business right now. So here's DHL's Pearson with Bloomberg's Francine Lacqua and Tom McKenzie.
We're releasing the Global Trade Atlas for the very first time in conjunction with our decade-long study in the level of global connectedness. And the summary of the Global Trade Atlas is that there's more, faster, broader, and changing. And I'll just talk to that for a couple of minutes there. There's more trade than there was pre-pandemic. The trade this year and next year is forecast to grow faster than pre-pandemic levels. The broadness talks to the nature of emerging economies and how they're getting a bigger slice of the pie. And the changing is the one I'm particularly interested in, is the fact that the emerging economies story is now firmly built on quality and not just necessarily quantity that it might have been a decade ago. They're taking the benefits of connectedness, they're taking the benefits of innovation, they're taking the benefits of digitalization, putting into the pot and making very precise and high-tech and innovative equipment that they're then exporting to the rest of the world. And the catalyst and the accelerant of all that, and it comes quite clearly through the study, is e-commerce, which is now into its sort of seventh or eighth year of quite stratospheric growth and was precipitated by the pandemic.
When you look at the supply chains in Europe, because of these higher energy costs, because of rationing in Germany, but also other countries, are you going to see some of those components that maybe used to be bought in Europe move elsewhere? So does it put further pressure on these supply chains?
I think that the supply chains have been built up on efficiency and economics. There's a little bit of there's some diversity required in those supply chains in terms of there's some clear evidence of China plus one and China plus two. And I think the nature of people's supply chains is dictated to a little bit by some of those rising costs. But one of the other things that the study absolutely confirmed, and the Global Connectedness did the same, is that the nature of long-distance trade, the kilometre distance transversed by trade, is basically 5,000 or 5,000-plus kilometres, which it was a decade ago. So that great sort of east-west trade route is still very much in place, and that delivers upon the requirements of efficiency and economics, which is what companies want to take their products to market at the most marketable cost, despite any levels of inflation caused by fuel, energy or anything else.
John, you touched on e-commerce and the growth of that part of the business, particularly when it comes to DHL. I'm just thinking there's a couple of big events coming up, shopping events. A lot of that will be done online, of course, whether it's Christmas or Chinese New Year or Black Friday. To what extent is the logistics business prepared for that? Is logistics, the logistics industry, is it over the struggles and the strains that we saw during the pandemic?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. You know, what is peak season going to be look like, and are people ready for it? We've spent the last 2.5 years finding more aviation assets that we could put into our network. In fact, we've added 80 or 90 new aircraft into our fleet since the last 2 years, and we've needed every single one of them. Capacity, 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 that gives lift, that gives quality, and that allows us to be prepared for peak season. There is always a hockey stick for peak season, which is defined by October 1 for DHL Express. The elevation of the hockey stick this year is completely unknown, and whether consumers start buying again rather than browsing. But what I can tell you is that every single merchant that started trading with us during the pandemic, when we had that 3 years of growth in 3 months, is still with us, trading at much lower levels. So those sort of nascent customers are ready to uptick again. But what the peak season really is like, we don't know.
So how worried are you about inflation? And actually, does it mean that people will go to stores instead of shipping, or that also some of your customers will have to go bust?
Well, I think global trade, you know, and the demand is, you know, proven to be very resilient. You know, from our point of view, it puts pressure on the supply chain, the fuel cost, which we have a natural mechanism of recovering that in terms of our fuel surcharge index, does put pressure on shipping. But people have moved over to express transportation for reliability of movement, for consistency of service quality, and for most of all, consistency of pricing, in that our customers only hear from us once a year in January, and then the prices are very stable and structured for the balance of the year, and they appreciate that in their planning very much.
And that was John Pearson, the CEO of DHL Worldwide, with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix and Tom McKenzie. And coming up, how much inflation is really lurking in the U.S. economy, and how far can the Fed push it with the rate hikes? You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Denise Pellegrini, and a lot of investors are betting these days on the direction of interest rates. And we got some pretty shocking calls this past week on how high U.S. interest rates might go, including from Mark Mobius, founding partner at Mobius Capital Partners. And he tells Bloomberg's Danny Berger and Manus Cranny, U.S. interest rates could go way higher than we think. Check this out.
There's no question that the Fed has a game plan. Their game plan is to make sure that the interest rate is higher than inflation. That's the way they believe the way to kill inflation. So you have 8% CPI. That means you have to have 9% interest rates. So we're going to see higher and higher rates if these CPI numbers keep on coming this way.
Wait, hang on, Mark. 9% interest rates? Is that where you see the peak?
Yes. If the inflation is 8, the Fed has to raise the interest rates higher than inflation in order to kill inflation. That's their belief, and that's the game plan.
So you're making a call 9% rates by the Federal Reserve of the United States of America. What, with more aggressive quantitative tightening? And what kind of an unemployment rate would 9% rates deliver for the United States?
Well, you know, the good news in America is, first of all, you've got a strong dollar, which means Americans are going to be able to import things much cheaper than previously. That's number one. And number two, you have a situation where Americans have lots of cash because their incomes from overseas are getting better and better. And my recent visit to the U.S. indicates that things are going very well for Americans. They're spending like crazy. So I don't see and of course, very big shortage of workers. If you go into any restaurant or any shop in New York or anywhere else in America, you'll find that they're looking for workers. So,
Mark, do you have a number in mind? Do you have a number in mind of what that actual unemployment rate would look like?
I think the unemployment rate is going to be much, much lower than, let's say, 5%. It depends on how you're measuring it, but that's my feeling.
Okay, so it's going to take a lot to take this money supply down. Can we just consider how they do that? The question I asked you was, do you see 9% rates in the United States of America and a more aggressive QT is the way to reduce, in part, this money supply. Is it through a more aggressive quantitative tightening in the United States of America to impact EFCON?
Yes. But one of the things you have to remember, and which is overlooked, and that is cryptocurrencies. I think the Fed and people in the policy-making level are not paying attention to the cryptocurrencies, which results in trillions of dollars of turnover. If you look at the cryptocurrency exchanges and how cryptocurrency is being created, this is a very big factor. Of course, not as big as money supply is measured in the U.S., but cryptocurrencies are huge, and they're having a wealth effect on many, many people, not only in the United States, but in the world. Many people are holding these cryptocurrencies and feeling wealthy. And that's another point that is being overlooked by policymakers, I believe.
Getting that CPI number, that sent Bitcoin lower by nearly 10%, Mark. And that's only with the market pricing in a peak at just above 4%. What will happen to Bitcoin and the rest of risk markets if these money markets, if bets start to coalesce around, as you see, 9% as the peak in Fed rates?
Well, that's a very good point. And now we're in a situation where there are so many people with cryptocurrencies, and it's a leading indicator. When they lose confidence, in other words, when they see the CPI rate moving up and they feel that, oh, the Fed is going to tighten, they lose confidence, and therefore they begin to sell their Bitcoin and their cryptocurrencies. So I believe that the cryptocurrencies, particularly Bitcoin, is a leading indicator to what is going to happen in the stock market.
Okay, well, let's just push that a little bit further, Mark. Let's just extrapolate what you've given to Danny and I. The risk is 9% rates. The risk is tighter QT. To me and to Danny and anybody else tuning in, that may well imply a much bigger ransacking of equity markets. How much more wealth demolition will come in equities if the trajectory that you've just put forward comes to play?
You must remember, we've already come down quite a lot. You know, we are in a bear market, no question about that. So I'm looking at maybe another 10, 15% before people wake up to the reality that there are some great companies out there that are beating inflation. In other words, are able to price their goods higher than inflation rate.
Well, what happens to your EM trades, to EM risk in this environment?
Well, if you look at EM currencies, almost without exception, they've all come down pretty substantially against the U.S. dollar, just like the euro has come down. Now, what that means is that for some of these countries that are export-oriented, they're going to be in a much better position to export to the U.S. So we have to pay attention to those companies. And then, of course, there are companies in these emerging markets that are doing very well domestically. In other words, they are exporting their software or their products and are spending locally in depreciated currencies. So we have to look for those companies that will be doing well. But if you look at the indices, of course, emerging markets index has been battered mainly because of China. China's down substantially. But at the end of the day, I think you're going to see some of these opportunities in emerging markets arising. And of course, there are some countries like Indonesia that are exporting a lot of palm oil and other commodities that are doing fairly well.
Mark, you've mentioned China there. Let's just get your thoughts. We've got a zero COVID policy. People are talking about a 2% growth level, and we have intervention on the yuan with the risk of more sanctions over Taiwan. It's a fairly bleak outlook. Lots of people have said to Danny and I they can live without China risk with that hit parade of risk on it. How folly would it be to live without China in my portfolio, or how bearish are you on your outlook for China?
I think it's probably a good idea to have very low weight in China at this stage of the game because of the reason that you just mentioned. There's lots of things hitting that market. The COVID, the crackdown, the election coming up, and so forth and so on. So I would say that, yes, probably to have a low weighting, but start looking for bargains in China, companies that are, as I mentioned, having pricing power, and there'll be some opportunities there. But generally speaking, Our bet is more on India, on Taiwan, and other countries.
And that was Mark Mobius, founding partner at Mobius Capital Partners, with Bloomberg's Danny Berger and Manus Cranny. And coming up, Amazon's big play for Thursday night football. You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Denise Pellegrini, and this was just a huge week for Amazon and Amazon Prime Video with that kickoff of the streaming service Thursday Night Football.
Thursdays, only on Prime Video, football is open.
And this could all be a game changer for Amazon, according to Marie Donahue. She's vice president of Amazon Global Sports Video. Here she is with Bloomberg's Emily Chang. Let's listen in.
Look, honestly, I think this will be as big as when the NFL went to cable back in 1987. You know, we know how NFL games legitimized and grew the cable business, and we think the same thing can happen for streaming.
So you led negotiations for this $13 billion 11-year deal. It is a massive deal. How did you convince the NFL that Amazon was the place to be?
Right. Well, you know, the NFL cares a lot about scale and reach, and we've got that. We've got that better than any other streaming service. They also care about production, and they knew we showed in Europe, and we also showed by our work in the U.S. that we can produce the best broadcast for fans. It's incredibly important to them. And one of the most exciting things for me is they care about innovation. You know, the NFL has been able to stay top of mind for sports fans for decades because they innovate and they move forward and they have that confidence. And that was one of the biggest tenets in our deal with the NFL. We agreed to push each other and to continue to push each other on innovating on behalf of sports fans. And it's something that's personally really exciting and something that really excites the team.
Talk to us then about how this benefits Amazon more broadly. You know, what's going to be your measure of success? Is it driving audience numbers? Is it driving more Prime memberships? Is it getting more customers to buy more Amazon products?
Number one, we think we can serve sports fans better. We can serve customers better. But we wouldn't be in this if we didn't think we could improve the experience and make it better for fans. But absolutely, there are great business opportunities here. Number one, we're Prime Video is a membership service, so we can attract more members to Prime. There are plenty of people who have Prime who maybe haven't streamed video on Prime Video. And then there are other folks who come in for Thursday Night Football and find things like Lord of the Rings. And, you know, we haven't even talked about advertising. You know, advertising, this is a game changer for advertising at Amazon. We have a very strong business already, but you can't beat, this is the most premium video advertising inventory out there. So it's a huge game changer for us in terms of advertising.
So how do you plan to leverage targeted advertising and do some things differently that maybe a traditional network wouldn't be able to do given all of the data and other ways you have to reach your customers?
Right. Well, I would start with, you know, we've done a deal with Nielsen. So we actually are the first streamer to do a deal with Nielsen. So we think that's really important because that is what advertisers and the industry follows are Nielsen ratings. On top of that, as you say, we have first party data and we'll use that data not only to measure our fans and to serve them better, but also to serve advertisers better. We can actually use that first party data to make the advertising more relevant, more targeted, more directed. So it's an incredible opportunity.
Now talk to us about the experience.
So first of all, we start with the basics. We think we will have the best game broadcast in the business. I mean, I've been in sports 20 years, and you always have to remember it starts and ends with the game. So we've got iconic broadcasters like Al Michaels and Kirk Herbstreit. We've got Kaylee Hartung on the sidelines. We've got more cameras than anybody. So when you turn on your big screen television or whatever device, or on every piece of glass, whatever you watch the game, you can sit back and relax and enjoy that huge big screen experience. But on top of that, we're an OTT service, so we're not satisfied with that. The bar for us is really high. We want to innovate. You can watch the game. You can sit down and watch with your family and watch the dudes, Dude Perfect. You can explore our X-ray experience, which is actually, without ever leaving the game, you can see all sorts of data and statistics and replays. The point of X-ray is actually to put the tools that normally you have to wait for a producer or director to say, oh, let me see that replay. Let me show you some extra stats. We're going to put that in the hands of fans. And then, of course, we have all the content around the game. And then we've got a great surrounding cast. Remember, we have Twitch, which is an incredibly young interactive audience. And, you know, Twitch is all about watching with your community. So we're excited. We're going to expand the communal nature of sports through Twitch. We are going to surround fans all week.
So the big question, of course, then is what next? Is Amazon planning to bid on any of the remaining college sports rights or the NBA? What else do you have coming?
So there's literally, I can't really think of any sports rights we don't look at. I mean, we're in business with the NFL. We're in business with the Yankees. You know, we provide local games exclusively in New York. So we're excited. The partners who are willing to come with us are the ones who are forward focused, fan focused, and really want to go, as you know, the old Wayne Gretzky, want to go where the puck is going, not where it's been.
And that was Marie Donahue, Vice President at Amazon Global Sports Video, with Bloomberg's Emily Chang. And coming up, what will the game of tennis serve up next? You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Denise Pellegrini. Tennis great Roger Federer hanging up his racket. The 41-year-old sharing the message with fans on social media this past week.
To the game of tennis, I love you and will never leave you.
Federer is a 20 Grand Slam champion. He also has the record of 237 consecutive weeks spent at number one. He hasn't played a competitive match, though, since Wimbledon 2021 due to that knee injury. And then, of course, there's the Serena Williams retirement at Arthur Ashe Stadium following her loss at the U.S. Open. She thanked her parents and, most of all, the greatest source of her competitive edge, her older sister, Venus.
I wouldn't be Serena if it wasn't Venus, so thank you, Venus.
And all this stepping away from the court by some of the sport's greatest stars is intensifying discussion here in the U.S. about the new up-and-coming players, including the young Francis Tiafoe, who made it to the men's semifinals before losing to Carlos Alcaraz.
I'm going to come back and I will win this thing one day. I'm sorry, guys.
Tiafoe is the first Black American to reach the semifinals since tennis great Arthur Ashe did that more than 50 years ago. And tennis star and ESPN commentator Patrick McEnroe says there are just some amazing stories behind some of the younger players who will infuse new energy in the sport. And here he is with Bloomberg's Kathleen Hayes. Let's listen in.
Francis Tiafoe's story is an incredible one. It's like an American fairy tale, really, with his parents coming from Sierra Leone, his mom working two jobs as a nurse, his dad being the head of maintenance at a tennis facility, and that's how Francis and his twin brother happened to get into tennis. Just amazing, but also these guys play with so much with athleticism, style, and they love it, and the crowds love them.
Well, I was fortunate enough to be in Arthur Ashe when Tiafoe beat Nadal. That was quite a moment for a lot of people. Not only the thrill of seeing this young man that we've been watching, just his acceleration in his development as a tennis player, right? And also for people, kind of their nostalgia about seeing Rafa Nadal, who's not done yet, presumably, but see him lose, not even get to the finals.
I mean, it was a great performance by Francis, and even though Nadal wasn't at his absolute best, he was still pretty darn good. And Tiafoe had to really play well and finish him off, because Nadal's not going to give anything away. And remember, Rafa hadn't lost a match in a major all year. He won the first two majors of the year in Australia and at the French Open, and then had to withdraw before his semifinal with Nick Kyrgios at Wimbledon because of the stomach injury. So because of the stomach injury all summer that he was nursing, he wasn't really at 100%. But again, that being said, he's still Rafa. You still got to finish him off. And Tiafoe did that, and then he came back to beat a very tough Andrei Rublev, the Russian, in the quarterfinals to make his move into the semifinals.
Oh yeah, he's a dynamo for sure. So is part of this new era about race, losing Serena, gaining Tiafoe? Is the new era about tennis also spreading to more different kinds of people in the U.S. and globally?
Well, it definitely has done that on the women's side. I mean, you saw the Serena and Venus effect with lots of young African-American women who are now not that young, but you've obviously got the youngest one in Coco Gauff, but you've had Madison Keys and Sloane Stephens and countless others. So I've seen it change even in the last 10 years, you know, attending a lot of junior tennis tournaments as I do, and even at our tennis academy at Randall's Island here, the McEnroe Tennis Academy. So I've seen the impact, you know, from all backgrounds of particularly young girls. And I hope that Tiafoe will have some impact on young boys, because I still think, at least in the United States, it's not as popular in the African-American community. Tennis, it is for women, I think, mostly because of Venus and Serena, and also because in professional women's tennis, you can make a lot of money. So that attracts more people of all different backgrounds to the sport.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas tennis, you know, for guys, for young boys, is not at the top of the list. But worldwide, right, you're actually right. I mean, the players coming from all over the world is just amazing. The popularity of tennis has grown in other parts of the world, especially in the last 20 years, which is why, in some ways, the U.S., I think, fell behind in creating and helping develop top players. But it's good to see that's, you know, on the women's side, we're doing very well.
Right.
And on the men's side, we're starting to see an impact of Tiafoe, Taylor Fritz, Tommy Paul, Opelka, Brooksby, Korda.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a good group of good, you know, really good young American men. But Tiafoe definitely is the most charismatic of all those players.
Uh-huh.
And he's the first one now to get through to a major semifinal.
I want to ask you a couple other questions looking ahead. For example, will someone not named Nadal win the French Open in 2023?
That's a great question, Kathleen. You know, some of it depends on the health of Nadal. He did look a little bit slower, which he actually admitted in his post-match press conference. I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes, someone will. I mean, it's got to happen at some point, right? I mean, I think with Alcaraz's development, Casper Ruud, who's a great clay court player, got to the finals last year losing to Nadal. He would be a guy. And Sinner, you know, Sinner, who lost to Alcaraz, can play on clay as well. So I think the younger generation, Not are they coming, Kathleen, they're here.
Yeah.
You know, they're here. And I think that Sinner-Alcaraz match was really, to me, a generational shift in the way the game is played.
Okay.
You know, the speed and the tempo that the match was played at was something I haven't seen before, quite
mm-hmm.
honestly. So whether one of those guys or someone else can put that together in a major at the French Open, if Nadal's healthy, will be something to see next year, and certainly be something to look for.
How about Novak Djokovic? He's in great shape. He wants to play. He wanted to play in this Open, and he couldn't. So what are his prospects looking like to you?
I think his prospects are great. I mean, obviously, it's been rough for him because of his decision not to be vaccinated to play a lot of tournaments. He hasn't been able to come to the U.S., and he's missed a lot of big events, obviously missed the Australian Open. Those are two tournaments where he'd be the favorite at. But I think, yes, he's still quick enough and nimble enough that he could play with these young guys, but I don't think for that much longer. I mean, that's how good I think these new players are. So, you know, I give him another 1 to 3 years probably, where if he can stay healthy mm-hmm. and motivated and get into countries, you know,
yeah.
It's not helping him that he's not able to play that many tournaments. But again, he knew what he was doing when he made the decision to not get back, and he's the only tennis player, at least in the top, you know, rankings of the world, that made that decision. But from a tennis standpoint, there's no doubt that he can still play at this level for a couple more years.
So another looking ahead question. We know Serena's retiring, so we can assume Venus is going to be retiring soon too. And maybe they're going to do tennis commentary. Could we maybe see them providing some mixed doubles commentary with a couple of brothers named McEnroe?
That would be awesome. That would be great. Although Venus hasn't said she's retiring, and in fact the USTA wanted to do a little tribute to her and she said no this year, so I think she's still going to play longer, but we would love it. McEnroe's would love that. The Williamses have done, you know, so much for the sport and for, you know, women in general, and obviously for black women and people of every background with what they've been able to do. So, you know, they may have bigger fish to fry. They've got their own businesses and their own interests, But we would love to have him anytime.
I just figured you'd say that. I have to ask one last question because I've got you on the phone. It's the electronic line calling system. I think a lot of fans have been looking at plays going, what the heck? That was out. And I think a clear example was the four-set tiebreak, right? The game with Nick Kyrgios and Karen Khachanov.
Right.
He hit the ball out. The crowd, everybody in that stadium said, oh, my God. And the line judge, the automatic line judge, didn't call it. Should chair umpires be allowed now to overrule the machine sometime if they see something like that?
Oh, that would create a monumental problem. But what it shows us all is that the human eye makes mistakes. And so I think that it's been great for tennis. Maybe taking a little of the drama out because, you know, the players now know that the call is the call as soon as it happens. But it is amazing to me, having, you know, watched the players closely the last couple of weeks, to see when they see a close call. And you could see before the challenge system or before even the electronic line call, they'd be arguing, they'd be going to the chair umpire going crazy.
Yeah,
I know somebody that would have done that consistently. Yeah. You may know him, John McEnroe.
Yeah.
I think it's made the game better. It's made the players sort of move on to the next thing. Again, you lose some of that, the characters, you know, yeah, arguing with the chair. But in the end, I think you're gaining a lot more with the use of the electronic line calling.
Truly my final question. What's your advice? You know, you run a tennis academy. You came up as a kid. You played tennis successfully as a pro. You're a successful commentator. What's your advice to a young person who's looking at tennis and going, well, I could afford the racket. There's a public court somewhere nearby. What would your advice about how to get into the sport, how to grow in the sport?
Number one is you got to enjoy it. I mean, I loved to hit against the wall when I was a kid. It was a singular thing to do. I love team sports as well. My brother and I played a lot of team sports growing up. But something about the, you know, the being on your own and hitting against the wall, you know, gives you repetitions. And it, you find out how much you like the game. So you have to enjoy the game, number one. And then you have to find a place where you can, you know, if you end up being a competitive player, you know, good system, good teachers around you. At our academy, you know, it's all about the team and all about the kids and their parents and the kids being with other kids. And I think sometimes tennis can become very lonely and very isolating. And particularly at our academy, we like the team environment. And that's something that Francis Tiafoe grew up at his training center in College Park, Maryland as well. He had a great support team around him. Mm-hmm. And that's important because it keeps it fun. You know, you have to learn when you're playing tennis. It's a game that is incredibly difficult to master. It takes a lot of time and, you know, tremendous amount of repetition and dedication to get really good at it at any level.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you need to have a great passion for the game and a great passion for learning and obviously for kids coming up having fun.
And you have been listening to tennis star and ESPN commentator Patrick McEnroe with Bloomberg's Kathleen Hayes. And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best. I'm Denise Pellegrini, and this is Bloomberg.